let's take a look at the foundation of everything that we're going to build on throughout our OAMA Advisor, whatever program you're in is going to build on this. You know, for over 6,000 years, going back to Solomon in the Old Testament, in the book of Solomon, it was philosophized that alcoholism was an illness. Solomon wrote of this. But he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. Gluttony is really, if you look up in any good dictionary, gluttony is what we're afflicted with. They call it compulsive overeating today, and that sounds nice. Does this serve a purpose here this evening? Okay. Be polite. If you look up in any good dictionary, you'll find that what we're really afflicted with is gluttony. Gluttony was philosophized as an illness. And you've heard this all your life. Lazy, weak will, if you only cared about your mother, if you cared about your father, if you cared about your children, your wife, your neighbor, you wouldn't eat that way. And Solomon thought that this was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In England, in about the time of 1640, there was a doctor, and this doctor's name was Dr. Trotter. And Dr. Trotter believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. And one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a man who George Washington would appoint as the very first Surgeon General of the United States, a man whose name was Benjamin Rush. And if you ever come to Chicago and you want to go to any of the touristy places, you'll undoubtedly be pointed to places on Rush Street, so named for him. There were other doctors and other people who didn't know what this was, but they tried to cure it anyway. In Pennsylvania in the 1880s, there was a doctor who tried to cure alcoholism because he believed that alcoholism stemmed from a deficiency of B12. And so he developed a wafer, a cracker, if you will, that he loaded with B12 that he believed would cure alcoholism and would stem masturbation. He believed that masturbation and alcoholism were evils in our society, and Dr. Graham developed his famous cracker in the 1880s. The Graham cracker was originally a cure, or I say cure in quotations, for alcoholism and masturbation. Of course, it's not like the graham crackers we buy today, which are like cookies. We give them to our kids and we eat them ourselves or whatever when no one's looking, but okay. So, in the 1920s in New York City, there was a man whose name was William Duncan Silkworth, and he was a physician. Dr. William Duncan Silkworth was a neurologist. He was not concerned with alcoholism. He wasn't concerned with defining it, and he wasn't concerned with finding a cure for it or a relief for it, recovery. On October the 29th, 1929, which we're going to talk about tomorrow as well, Dr. Silkworth lost everything he had that was tied up in the New York Stock Exchange on Black Tuesday. October 29, 1929, is the beginning of the Great Depression. Dr. Silkworth lost everything he had. And at that time, in the 1920s, the most preeminent hospital in the world for the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction was the Towns Hospital in New York, so named after its owner and founder, Charles Towns. And Charles Towns was a friend of Silkworth, and Towns offered him a job for $35 a week. And in November of 1929, William Duncan Silkworth went to work at the Towns Hospital in New York. And he treated alcoholics by giving them B12 and giving them medical attention and trying to get them back into society. And he observed that the alcoholics, now these were primarily men. There were some women, but mostly men. They would come in deplorable shape, deplorable condition. And they would feed them and attend to their needs, and they would send them home. And there was, most of these men would never return. They would learn their lesson. They would not return. However, there was a group of these guys, about 10% of them, 1 out of 10. And these guys would come in, and he would treat them, and he would fix them up, and he would attend to them, and within a very short period of time, they'd be back in worse condition than he had ever seen them. Terrible. And he started to notice some things about these men that set them apart from the other men. And what he noticed was that there was something different about the way they thought, and there was something different about their body, and their bodies reacted differently to alcohol than the other 90% that came in and left and never returned. If you have your big book with you, let's go to page XXB, 25 in Roman numerals. This chapter used to be the first chapter of the big book, and Bill's story used to be the second chapter. And he was moved to the Roman numeral section because he is not an alcoholic. And the book is, the body of the book is supposed to be for alcoholics, by alcoholics, and Silkworth is not an alcoholic. So they moved it to the Roman numeral section. And you all know that if it's in the Roman numeral section, you don't read that part. But if we don't, we're going to really be screwed, because this is the basis of the knowledge that we must have. And I repeat that word must very strongly if we're to continue on with our program of recovery. Page XXB or 25. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. And of course, they're talking about William D. Silkworth. Now, here's a little interesting fact that you may not care about, but I'll give it to you anyway. In the first 10 printings of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Silkworth's name is not in the book. Because he said to Bill Wilson, I will write this for you, but don't you put my name in there. He said, because they'll run me out of the medical profession. In 1949, 10th printing of the big book is coming up. The 10th printing coincided with 1949, and a noted psychiatrist, Harry Thibault, who was instrumental in Bill Wilson's life and in some of the direction that the book takes too, Harry Thibault was actually on the AA board as a non-alcoholic. He wrote a paper where he believed that alcoholism was an illness, and it was accepted by the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association. And Dr. Silkworth told Bill Wilson, you can put my name in there now. But before that, he wouldn't let his name go in there because he was afraid of being run out. Because these opinions that we're going to read tonight are quite controversial for their time. For their time, they were revolutionary. And he was afraid. But Silkworth died in 1951, but he remains today our great medical benefactor. We wouldn't have a program today if it wasn't for people like William Duncan Silkworth. He gave us every piece of information we need for step one, the powerless condition. Let's see what he writes, and let's examine it and see how it tallies with your life. To whom it may concern, excuse me, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. And when he uses this word hopeless in this book, what I want you to ask yourself is, are you out of ideas yet? Are you hopeless that you can handle this by yourself? Because if you're sitting here and you're thinking of ways that you're going to control this yourself, you're going to handle this yourself, then there's nothing we can do for you. You are beyond us. Hopeless equals out of ideas. Tom Washington in Chicago used to poke his finger in my shoulder and say, are you out of ideas yet, kid? Are you out of ideas yet, kid? Because I was in my early 20s, I was 24 years old. And he'd say, are you out of ideas yet, kid? Because, that's what he used to say. I attended a patient who, though he had been a in the course of his third treatment, now, we're going to see when we do Bill's story tomorrow, that he's going to be hospitalized in that story 3 times. But something very, very special is going to happen between the second hospitalization and the third hospitalization in December of 1934. We're going to examine that tomorrow, and we're going to find out what happened between his second and his third hospitalization. He acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery, and this would be the Oxford Group 6 Steps. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now, don't you dare go to bed one night in your life and not thank your lucky stars for the first 100 alcoholics who recovered, because you owe them a debt. You owe them, you owe them, you owe them, you owe them. They carved a path where none existed. They didn't have the men's retreat. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have the phone meetings. They didn't have an inner group. And they didn't have the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, or what do you have, the Oasis out in San Diego, and you have your meeting. They didn't have what somebody in this room developed of the podcasts and all that. They couldn't go to the podcasts. They were passing the program one to the other, and they would follow this guy for a while, and then they would follow that guy for a while, and they carved the path when none existed, so you could be here tonight, so you could be alive. Don't go to bed without thanking God for those first 100 alcoholics. I know personally scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. Every method I tried failed completely, or I'd be sitting home watching God knows what tonight, or doing what, or I'd be dead. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. And William Silkworth remains, as I said before, our great medical benefactor. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to elaborate upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement he confirmed what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. And this is groundbreaking information. We're going to talk about a word a little later on. The word is allergy, and that's a word that stumped me for a long time. and it explained things I had no explanation for. Let's get to it and let's see what we find. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy, there's that word, to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And when he's talking about explaining things which we cannot otherwise account, what that means is, I never ate one cookie unless it was the last cookie I could get my hands on. If I ate one, I ate 10. And in a normal person's body, when they eat food, the more they eat, the less hungry they are. In my body, the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat, and it is just endless. So if we look at this word allergy, and we look it up in a thing called a dictionary, some of you are old enough to remember a dictionary, before we had Wikipedia and before we had Wi-Fi and all that other stuff, I looked up this word allergy and it said something there that caught my eye. It said an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. Adverse means it's harmful. Abnormal means most people don't react that way. In my body, the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat, and it is just endless. There is no end to it. In a normal person's body, they have the same relationship with food that I have with the gasoline in my automobile, which is at Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix right now. I have my car, and every once in a while I have to take my car to the gas station and fill it up with fuel. And I have a certain sense that it's a pain in the ass. It costs me money, I don't really want to do it, I don't get any thrill out of it, but if I don't take my car over to the gas station, I'm not going to be able to get where I want to go. And that's the relationship that they have with food. And that's why we don't understand why they don't eat the way we do, and they don't understand why we eat the way we do. Because we're going to talk on the next page about something that we get from the food that they don't get from the food, and that's going to be called the effect. That food does something for me that it does not do for them. It gives me an instant sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating a Kit Kat bar, eating Raisinets, Doritos, ice cream, that they don't get. And so if the food isn't doing it for them, they're not attracted to it in the mind, and if they don't have the allergy, they don't set up the craving, and they can control the amount they eat. Let's take a look at what we're going to see, and we're going to re-examine this on the next page. This is not the last time we're going to go through this, because one of my goals for coming up here this weekend is to explain this so that we have an understanding of it, because so many people are walking around OA, sometimes for decades, that have no idea what the first step means. They're looking at it and they say, we were fat and couldn't stay on our diets and had no willpower. That's not what it says. That's not what it says. Okay. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us, as laymen, our opinion as to his soundness may mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense and explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or before. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. What's he telling you here? He's going to tell you that three times in the chapter. You've got to put down the food. There's nothing we can do. If you're eating Kit Kat bars, if you're eating Raisinets, there's nothing we can do for you. You're drunk. There's nothing we can do. Go to an AA meeting. They don't tell them in there, keep drinking and work the steps. They tell them you've got to plug the jug and then you can work the steps. Any AA members in here that go to AA, do they say keep drinking and work the steps, or do they say stop drinking and work the steps? I don't know. Okay. The doctor writes, the subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We're going to cover the next paragraph twice. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Let's look at it again on the change a few words. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond medicine's control. Medicine's conception. What with medicine's ultra-modern standards, medicine's scientific approach to everything, doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our medical knowledge. What's he telling you here? We know what's wrong with you. There's not a damn thing we can do for you. I know what's wrong with you, said the doctor. There is nothing I can do for you. Nothing. They understand that they are as powerless as you are. My cardiologist that I go to because I have AFib. AFib is atrial fibrillation. My heart kind of goes a little fast on the top. He tells me the same thing. He stopped saying anything to a lot of his patients. They don't listen anyway. They don't listen. There was a doctor not long ago. He won't take a patient over 200 pounds. If you're over 200 pounds, he will not accept you in his practice. He will not do it. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive in their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power. Watch your capitals here. Power is capitalized, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be free from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. What's he telling you for the second time? Put down the food. Put down the food. We cannot do anything for you when you have Kit Kat bars in your mouth. Nothing. When you have chunky wrappers in your pants pockets, there's nothing we can do for you. You've got to put down the food. We believe in so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. And the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. You talk about once having lost their self-confidence. Are you kidding me? I had no confidence in anything because everything I tried in this area was an utter and complete failure. And if I couldn't stop eating the pizza, and I couldn't stop eating Kit Kat bars and Raisinets and ice cream, then how was I supposed to go into the world with any type of confidence at all whatsoever? How was I supposed to look at a goal and think that I could hit that goal? How was I supposed to go into the world where there's girls and think I can seduce them or have them or talk to them? And how was I supposed to go into the world where there's careers and think I can achieve great things? How am I supposed to go into the world and think that the life that I see most of you living is to be mine when I can't even stop eating Kit Kat bars and Raisinets? that if I'm an utter failure, and then it says to them, their reliance upon things human. I was waiting for someone to come and fix me, and that job is God's job, and my job is to find God. That no human power, we're going to read tomorrow, that no human power, be on page 60, could have relieved my alcoholism, my compulsive overeating. Their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. When 99% of my brain power is being used to eat or not eat, hide the food, hide myself, obtain the food, pass the bad check, not pay my taxes, run away from the landlord, not pay my bills. Oh my God, how in the world am I supposed to solve problems? How in the world am I supposed to solve problems when 100% of my brain power is in eating, hiding, money? How was I supposed to have anything left to give to a problem? And so I avoided work, and the problems piled up on me, and it became true. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. And that means begging me, bribing me, beating me into trying to go on a diet is going to become an utter failure. If you're sitting here against your will, if you're sitting here and you really don't want to be here, go home. Because fluffy emotional appeal seldom suffices. It never suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. And that means that if you are a recovering compulsive overeater, that God's got a job for you. And you are going to be sent in where others cannot go. You will have the language of the heart that you speak. You will speak and understand the language of the heart where other people will not. And you can be helpful and you can be useful where others cannot be. And my God, the pain that drives men and women to these rooms. I've often said this, that every door of an OA meeting should be a Dutch door. And a Dutch door, if you don't know, is a door that opens and closes independently, its top and its bottom. And the top should be nailed shut so that if you do not crawl in, you will not stay. If you don't crawl in here on your stomach, you will not stay. You will not do the work. And there are people in here, and there are people in other rooms of OA tonight, around this country, that have been raped, that have been molested, that have been abandoned, that have been given up on, that have been ostracized, that have been beaten up physically. More than once I have been in OA meetings where gals have had the shit beat out of them by their husbands or boyfriends for gaining weight. In more than one OA meeting, I have been in meetings with men whose girlfriends or wives have cut them off from any type of affection or physical intimacy because they gained weight. I have had divorce threatened, and I have had all kinds of things that I've seen in my 35 years in OA. There is a tremendous amount of pain that goes into this. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, my gosh, my life is fantastic. I think I'll go join OA. It doesn't work that way. You come here as the last house on the block. And normally, when you're addicted to other things, and this is going to be a little controversial, please, this is my opinion, please don't throw this in my face. This is the toughest addiction there is. I've seen alcoholics and drug addicts and Al-Anons, and I've seen all kinds of people, and I'm not diminishing these addictions. They come in here and they run out screaming because the level of excavation that is required in OA is much deeper and much more cleansing and much more strenuous than any level of excavation needed to recover from other addictions. At the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, where I go, there's a triple or quadruple room where the alcoholics meet, and then we meet in what's called room two, and then room three is for Narcotics Anonymous, Al-Anon, gamblers, Pills Anonymous, whatever, codependent. We get some of these guys come over from the AA side, and we never see them again. Because they're astonished at how much work is required in a way that they never had to do. They've got 20, 30, 40 years of sobriety. And they're 350 pounds. And they can't take the food out of their mouth. Why? Because this is work that they don't have to do in those other programs, and they're just astonished. So in order to aid that, if you are a recovering compulsive overeater, you will be sent in to help God where others cannot go, because you are uniquely qualified. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics may appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children, let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Men and women, now this paragraph that we're going to read right now is one we're going to be referring to not only for the rest of the weekend, we're going to be referring to this for the rest of our lives. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. When they're not eating, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity, and what impunity simply means is indifference. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, spiritual awakening, there is very little hope of his recovery. So let's take a look at what we've got going here. We've got a mind that is different from normal people. When my mind is scared, angry, selfish, self-seeking, happy, sad, all human beings have emotions. All of them. They have a name for people that have emotions. They're called human beings. But there's a difference. In a normal person's mind, when they are sad, happy, scared, angry, jealous, their mind does not lock in on the sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating a Kit Kat bar. Are you with me? Because in their mind, the Kit Kat bar does not produce the effect. They go home, they yell at the dog, they yell at their wife, they drive like John. They talk. They give people the finger. Whatever it is that they do. They do what it is that they do, and it's over. I'll teach you a Yiddish word. Genug. What does genug mean? Enough. Enough. When my mother and I'd be screaming at each other, my father would have it. He would get up. He would take his hat off, take the cigarette out of his mouth, and say, genug. That meant any further yelling, and you won't be happy with the result you're going to get. You're not going to like what's going to happen next. That's your first warning. Genug. It's done. Now, the food is doing something for the compulsive overeater that it does not do for the non-compulsive overeater or the normal person. It gives me an instant effect, the sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating the food. Now, my brain locked in on that sense of ease and comfort when I was about 4 seconds old. And my brain understands very well through repetition that this works beautifully. And if this was the only thing that was a little different about me, I'd be fine. I'd get scared. I'd get angry. I'd get jealous. I'd get selfish. I'd get self-seeking. I'd have guilt. I'd have shame. I'd have remorse. I'd eat one Kit Kat bar and I'd be fine. That wouldn't be so bad. But the minute that Kit Kat bar, the minute that Butterfinger hits my system, what else triggers involuntarily, automatically, gravitationally? The physical allergy. So in other words, I want the food because I don't feel quite right. My brain says, no, don't eat the food. We've got a crush on this girl. We want to look good for the girl. Don't eat the food. Then I get mad at Bob. He's wearing a red shirt. I told him 4 times, if I'm coming up here, wear a blue shirt. I come up here, he's wearing a red shirt. Son. Anyway. So I'm mad at Bob. At that moment, I can abdicate responsibility for eating a Kit Kat bar, and I can shift the blame to him. Because that's what I love about a resentment. Now, this is happening in lightning speed in your brain. You don't even know it's happening. So eventually, I can justify eating a Kit Kat bar, and I eat it, and what happens? I trigger the physical allergy. Now, if I can't eat because of the allergy, and I can't keep from eating because of my brain, I am powerless over food, and my life is unmanageable. I'm checkmated. I can't eat because of the allergy, and I can't keep from eating because of the twist of the mind. I'm powerless over food, and my life's unmanageable. That's step one. But what if I could find a way to live where my emotions do not build up to the level that demands the food? What if I could find a way to live where once I get mad at Bob, I work the steps and I already feel better, and I don't have to eat a Kit Kat bar or Raisin Nets? The process of bringing that good feeling into my head through the working of the steps, through reaching for a God that I am willing to believe in, a God of my understanding, is called recovery. And that's what this is all about, Charlie Brown. What we're going to do this weekend, and what we're going to do hopefully for the rest of your life and my life, is we're going to replace the effect of the food for the effect of the working of the steps, and we're going to trade a moment of pleasure for a lifetime of happiness. That I'm going to get the same effect from working the step on that resentment against Bob for wearing the red shirt that I got from the Kit Kat bar with none of the devastating side effects. And that's what this is all about. And I don't know how to break it down any simpler. But this is what we're talking about, and this is what we're dealing with. And this paragraph is the absolute summation of everything that has been going on in my head and in my body from the day, from the minute, the second I was born. Let's continue. And tomorrow we're going to talk about man who's afflicted with this, and we're going to look at his life. I hope this is still working. And we're going to look at how he is powerless, and we're going to take a look at that tomorrow. On the other hand, XXIX or 29 in Roman numerals, on the other hand, strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change, spiritual awakening has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems, he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. What are the rules? The steps. Good. Who said that? I think it was Victor. Or, that's good. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despair appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. If he's faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. Here's that controversy again. I have had many men who have, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date. The phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. These men were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their control. What were they feeling that drove them into the food? When this important appointment was impending, they felt fear. And fear is the most effective signal for the mental twist to activate to send me into the Kit Kat bar. Fear. They were afraid that the meeting wasn't going to go their way. And we're going to find out a little later on that fear, anger, selfishness, self-seeking, dishonesty are the triggers that are going to drive me irresistibly into that food. And so they took a drink thinking that they could take a drink. Remember we read the words, they cannot tell the truth from the false? Does that mean you think Rhode Island is in Alaska? No. What it means is you think that this time it's okay. That this time you can put the genie back in the bottle. That this time you'll get the toothpaste back in the tube. And we know we can't. And they took a drink and they blew the whole thing. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving is late, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And let's take a second, and I know it's late, and I know some of you are sound asleep, but let's take a second and give a second to those people who are dead from this illness that you know. The people that you left behind, the people that you buried, that they went out and they ate themselves, death by Dorito. They went out of this world, death by Dorito. They would not put down the food. And we miss them terribly. And our world has a gaping wound on it from those people's losses. How many of you are afflicted by people who are still alive but in the throes of their illness, in the throes of their addiction, and their addiction has ransacked your life and the lives of people around you, and your addiction has ransacked theirs? There is a better way, and it's in this book. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. Tomorrow we're going to find out that step 3 is a decision and a beginning. There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is a manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, is the manifestation of an allergy, that's the physical craving, the allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. What's that last part telling you? Put down the food. Maybe I didn't mention this before. You've got to put down the food. So if you ask me later, I'm going to tell you, you've got to put down the food. Because we can't touch you while you're eating Kit Kat bars. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the great opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought into the treatment for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had given it a deserving bound, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and, in desperate condition, brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, spiritual awakening, and we doubted if that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray, William D. Silkworth, M.D. Before I turn you loose, of the few of you that are remaining awake, let's just very quickly look at what we have here. Step one. We, not you, not me, not we, were powerless over food and our lives were unmanageable. Powerless over food has nothing to do with willpower. It has to do with a hopeless condition of the mind and a hopeless condition of the body. Now, there is nothing we can do about the mind, the allergy. As some of you may have noticed, I have hay fever. I have rose fever. I'm allergic to dust. I'm allergic to certain things. Some of you have heard me on various retreats through the years, and I'm always blowing my nose because I have a lot of allergies. There is nothing medical science can do for my allergies. They can treat the symptoms of my allergy by pills that taste like garbage. If you've ever bitten into one, which I did by mistake, I would rather drink sewer water than taste whatever that is. But what that pill does is it just dries me out, and the actual pill makes me more uncomfortable than the chafrezer condition. Chafrezer condition means stuffed up condition. Okay? Now, we were powerless over food, and our lives had become unmanageable. If I can't eat because of the allergy, and I can't keep from eating because of the mental twist, I'm powerless over food. We're going to read words in chapter 2, which we won't have time to go over, but it's going to say the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. And it also says the cessation of eating is but a beginning. The cessation of eating is but a beginning. That's why diets don't work. Powerless. Tomorrow, we're going to examine where step 2 comes from. And we're going to examine the power that will conquer. the power that will overwhelm this hopeless condition so we can live emancipated. See you all tomorrow. If you're not asleep, go home, and if you are asleep, we'll wake you in the morning.